Hi, and welcome to the Inside Out Security Show. I'm your host, Cindy Ng, and I'm joined by security experts who will introduce themselves. And since summer is around the corner and students might be looking for internships or graduating soon, for those who might have an interest in InfoSec, do you have sage career advice?
Hi, this is Killian, and I'll reiterate something that one of my former bosses told me, and that's it's always worth a shot to take a risk. Just go for something. It might not be exactly, you know, your ideal, your dream, but what's the worst that can happen? You start over. Typically at that point, you don't have a mortgage and things like that where you have to pay the bills. So it's worth taking those long shots.
This is Chris Kaiser. When you're approaching different avenues, you know, different internships, different potential jobs, I would say it's key to show you've done your homework. Definitely show that you are up to date on what's happening in the world of InfoSec. Show that you have an avid interest in it, even potentially beyond what would be strictly professional, you know, showing that you have that interest, that drive to explore things and kind of take them apart and understand how they all work on the back end. That's something that I think a lot of employees would definitely appreciate, seeing that you have that independent desire to learn, independent desire to grow.
I'm not going to disagree with either of those things. I was just going to suggest sort of a way to demonstrate that, because I think that gets said a lot. And especially if you're new, you're not quite sure how to do that. So my suggestion was going to be that you get more involved with open source, that there's a lot of open source applications out there, and that if you can contribute to them in some way, that's something that really makes you stand out. And it's something that's very legitimate thing to be proud of and to, you know, express to future employers. Even if it's something as simple as just improving the documentation for some security tool, that's still a good contribution and something worthwhile and something to be encouraged.
Thanks, guys. So before we begin, I have a housekeeping announcement. If you're a regular listener and enjoy our show, and even if you don't, I'd like to know too, please go to iTunes and review the Inside Out Security Show, and we'll put you in the running for a deck of our InfoSec cards that's based on the Cards Against Humanity card game. And to learn more, please visit veronis.com/review. And on to today's show. So there's a stigma in the InfoSec space that we're all know-it-all techies who can't communicate with others. And I have to say, I'm pretty lucky to have coworkers and colleagues who are know-it-alls in a good way, because they also have a great sense of humor and they're easy to build rapport with. We've spoken about boards not understanding IT or that they need cybersecurity to be a greater priority. And in a recent article, boards are speaking back and they're telling us of really important insights that it was polled that half of board members say IT and security executives will lose their jobs because of failing to provide them with useful and actionable information. More than half of them agree or strongly agree that data presented is too technical and tech people aren't accurately defining risk. How are we miscommunicating here? What should be the main takeaway from this article?
It's something that I deal with all the time. I think there's kind of traditionally a gap in knowledge between the technical side of things and the business side of things. And that's something that, as somebody who does what I do, I have to try and bridge that gap on a regular basis. The closest thing I can compare it to is if you and your friends communicate a certain way because of the interests you share, and there's people in the world who would have zero idea what you're talking about. And it's always a challenge, regardless of whether this is, you know, in a professional capacity or in a casual capacity, to kind of bridge that gap. Like if I walk into a sports bar and try to talk to people about synthesizers or talk to people about coding or talk to them about topics that they have no idea where I'm coming from, they have no background in that whatsoever, it's always going to be a challenge. I'll definitely admit that in the past, I've been guilty of making things far too technical because I think I'm used to talking to people who have that same knowledge set and that same background. The communication breakdown often comes when you have to, again, bridge that gap to somebody who's never heard of this before, barely knows what a server is, barely knows what DNS is, barely understands what firewalls are or why someone would want to steal their data in the first place or anything like that.
So this is Mike. Richard Feynman was a physicist and really interesting guy and worked on the Manhattan Project and things. And I'm going to butcher the quote here, but it's something along the lines of, you know, you don't really understand something sufficiently until you can explain it in a simple manner. I think there's a lot that the IT side of it, which most of us live on, don't really understand about the business side. And it's really the interaction of those two that then determines what the risk is. And while it's very easy to say that certain things should be done, I think a lot of the risk comes from business things that are much, much more difficult to control or to evaluate. And I think that's where it's very hard to make good recommendations and to really explain things well.
In terms of practical tips, I think Chris is kind of on the right track. One of the things, it's like anything else, like public speaking even, it requires practice. And I don't think a lot of people get the opportunity to practice that, at least not until they're kind of in the hot seat. Being able to practice it and have those conversations with different folks, just go out and, you know, maybe not strike up a conversation about synthesizers in a sports bar, but hey, give it a try. I think part of the other aspect of it too is if you know you have to do this presentation or if you suspect you might, go through a simplification exercise. Write down what you want to communicate and see if you can, you know, maybe you come up with like, let's say a paragraph. See if you can boil that down to two or three sentences. See if you can boil down the concept to maybe a sentence. And it's really an exercise in simplification, and it really helps kind of refine a message. I do that sometimes when I have to write things too. Look for kind of the technical words in there and see if you can eliminate them or communicate the concept differently. And as Chris said, I am a huge proponent of telling stories or communicating things in analogies. I use that all the time, especially when I do presentations, because there's concepts that you can make, you know, a little bit universal and communicate the same information.
Ooh, let's practice now. I'm trying to bookend an article that came out of an MIT article on monetizing data collection with the lawsuit that Bose headphones had, where they collected user data and they started selling their information without their permission. And I'd like to blend those to take us through a journey of, okay, well, we want the business to keep running, so we need to monetize something somehow. And so how we do that securely and to maintain people's privacy. And so to structure the journey, let's use the different ways the article suggested you can monetize data. First is you can use data to improve internal business processes and decisions. Let's pretend you've all decided that the SIM tool that you have isn't enough. They give you too many false positives and you don't have enough resources to check on every single alert that you get. And let's say you want a new tool like a UBA tool. So how would you explain this to a business person who's supposed to approve the budget? How can you relate this back to the business?
We were talking a lot about analogies, and I think they can be good or bad. I think, especially in terms of talking to business people, you need to choose the right level of abstraction. And probably the wrong level of abstraction is almost to try to explain all of these things, to explain like what the actual products do in some great amount of depth, which is weird because that's what we love. Like, that's what I like to know and understand. Perhaps the most powerful analogy in security and IT is the concept of surface area. Surface area is the amount of area that can be attacked. And so it's an abstraction of the overall risk. And that you can imagine if you have a very small surface area, there's not a lot of risk. But if you have a very large surface area, there's a tremendous amount of risk. Security is not a binary thing. It's not secure or insecure. It's more or less.
I'll take a shot with analogies. To explain it to somebody completely non-technical, everybody, I'm sure, in their life has had to find parking, maybe in an urban area or city or where it's a little bit limited. Or they've at least seen online some of the crazy parking signs. You know, the signposts with 15 different placards with different, no parking between 12 and 6 on opposite sides, only on, you know, the third Sunday of a leap year. And people look at this and they go, I don't understand anything that's going on here. I can't follow what this is telling me. There are so many things that are alerting me, in a sense, to something that might be going wrong. That's what an unrefined SIM may be doing to the business. It's sending up so many different alerts that you have trouble figuring out what's applicable when, just like these signs. The way that I'd boil down maybe applying UBA to it is having somebody there to tell you what's really pertinent at this time. It analyzes all of the different data on those signs and says, hey, listen, at this time of day, this is what you need to be worried about, and gives you just that little bit of information that's actionable and you can make a decision on it immediately. We'll see after this episode if I get to keep my job.
The next round of practices. Let's pretend we're a wearables company and we want to develop these amazing swimsuits to help swimmers swim faster and help them improve their health. So IT, they've decided to collect data on a person's heart rate after they swim and how it might impact their cholesterol. So how would you explain this scenario to a business person who, let's say, needs to keep the person's heart rate number and cholesterol levels secure? Why is that important? Besides meeting compliance, you know, you can strong arm someone into meeting compliance, but they need to always be monitoring. How would you get an IT person to explain this to the board or the business?
I think the best way to approach that is, and this is kind of comparable to the whole Bose situation, you know, they're collecting information, but they're not sure what the ethics are of what that data can actually do. I would definitely point them in the direction of just helping them to understand why the data is sensitive in the first place, comparing it to, you know, what if you went to the doctor and you had a stress test done for your heart and it showed that you may have had some sort of, my cardiology knowledge is not perfect, but, you know, you have some sort of issues with your heart. There may be, you know, problems with that. That is information that is sensitive to you and personal to you. And you probably wouldn't want somebody walking into that office and walking on and taking that information or paying for that information, potentially securing that data, whether it's paper, you know, it's a physical, you know, EKG output, or if it's, you know, even just data points that you're getting from this wearable. That's information that has value, and you have to assume that people do not want that to get out.
See, I'm not even sure that's the case, though. Like, especially with a lot of these IoT companies, as we found out, and that's sort of what this is. What is considered personally identifiable information and that needs to be disclosed by law varies by state wildly. And so I'm actually looking at the list now. So say you had just what was described, you had some sort of health app and it had recipes in it. Like you're supposed to log your food. Like, okay, well, that's fine. And if there's a data breach, well, people, their food information, that's not considered sensitive. But if it's health information that it has their heart rate in it, suddenly this is a whole different class of application. And suddenly if you're in, you know, Arkansas, Florida, Illinois, or Missouri, you have a data breach. Now you have to contact the attorney general. You have to follow specific guidelines on doing a notification to all the affected people. You may or may not have to, you know, run through a whole bunch of other kind of things. And I know Cindy was saying, what's the way to describe this as in terms of, this is not in terms of compliance, but I kind of think that needs to happen, that you do need to describe it in terms of compliance, because so much of the rest of this is abstract. And the laws are, in a sense, you know, to keep us all safe and to put some sort of action and awareness around a specific thing that wasn't there before.
I agree with that. I think you have to look at it from not just the legal implications, but also the reputational implications of this. Regardless of what the law says, customers, if they found out about it, would, you know, potentially stop buying your product or using your product. I think both of those are valid concerns.
But if you just make it a compliance or law thing, why would you even need to bring it up with the board? They'd be like, oh, well, you know, have the lawyers take care of it then. And then you have these problems with the lawyers writing super long and ambiguous terminology in the terms and conditions. And okay, here you go.
To me, this is an interesting crossover where if you said to board members, we have an IT decision here that the consequences of, if there's a data breach, will mean we need to contact the attorney generals of a dozen states or we won't. I imagine that would get their attention. Like that's the kind of thing that they would pay very much attention to.
You know, what would be really helpful if we actually spoke with an actual board member? Let's move on to a next problem that IT people have is, in addition to communicating with board members, there's that age-old problem of using passwords. And Killian, you found this awesome article where Microsoft replaced a password with a phone-based login. I found another article where a Swedish startup called Epicenter, you can implant a microchip the size of a piece of rice between your thumb and your index finger. finger, and you can use that implant to authenticate and open doors and pay for stuff. And we see a lot of verticals trying out different ways to authenticate. Like last week, we talked about authenticating with your face. We've talked about cardless ATMs. Do you think we'll inadvertently end up with all these different methods, and it might end up becoming a security problem that we've never anticipated? Or maybe I'm just a little too paranoid, and maybe it's a good thing.
I don't think you're being too paranoid. You may not be being paranoid enough. My thought here is, you know, if you think about other ways to do it, two-factor security is something you have and something you know. If you're turning it into, I have my phone, so clearly I'm me, that I think it's not perfect. And it also opens up the possibility of people realizing if I have Chris's phone, I can effectively do everything Chris, you know, can. I can log into everything Chris ever had. If we're moving towards that, that probably is going to lead towards, you know, people stealing your phone. Now, when you compare that to say, oh, you have a microchip in your hand, I think I'd rather have someone steal my phone than steal my hand. That's the kind of thought process that I have at this point. I think it's nice to have something that is convenient and easy to use, but I think in terms of putting all your eggs in one basket, it makes me a little bit nervous.
I think, at least in terms of unpacking some of the articles a little bit, it's encouraging that tech companies are starting to consider alternatives to the password. I think the general consensus, at least in the security community for a long time, is that passwords have had their heyday. And we're beyond that. And there's got to be a better way. And at least they're looking at different solutions here. The Microsoft one is at least interesting, but as Chris mentioned, it only kind of changes the problem. It doesn't solve the problem. You'll put in your username, for example, and then your phone will get a message on the app saying, hey, confirm your login. It's just changing where you're doing that. Somebody could theoretically make it slightly easier in some ways. They couldn't mass collect your information, like stealing credentials out of a database dump or something like that that wouldn't hash properly. So it would eliminate some of the mass collection concerns, but in micro level, it would open up people who had their phones stolen potentially to maybe greater data loss if those guys could use it to log into other services. So it's a trade-off. It's just kind of moving the problem a little bit in one direction or another. You know, Google has the Authenticator app, and I think Microsoft can do this as well too, where it does offer that two-factor because we have our phones and it's a little bit better of a way, which I think is encouraging, but at least we're thinking of alternatives. You know, maybe the greater good in this case is getting away from the mass data collection of passwords, at least its surface area is a little bit smaller. If you have to steal an individual phone, then we're dealing with more targeted attacks or crimes of opportunity. I don't know. There's a lot of trade-offs.
No, so I'm going to come down on the side of, I think the Microsoft setup is a big improvement. And sure, by no means is, like I was saying, none of this is black and white. None of this is instantly secure, but I think it's better. And the more incremental steps towards better in terms of convenience and in terms of security that we can get, I think the better off we are. And, you know, in general, you're supposed to keep your phone locked down anyway with a code or your fingerprint swipe. This definitely seems to remove whole classes of attacks or to make those types of attacks much more difficult. So I look at this as something that's a very positive step forward. So.
Mike, I have to give it to you. You're so prescient. A year ago, I still remember we did a show with, I think it was just you, me, and Rob, and we were both like, well, passwords are going to hang around for a while. And you're like, let's move on. That's so 1990s.
You know, where computing happens so much now is on the phone. And phones and mobile devices of all kinds, just really hard to see, gee, we're going to use a password for this for forever. Like it seems like a relic of another time.
Yeah. So lastly, another Microsoft-related story last week, there was a secret organization or group or person called the Shadow Brokers, and they leaked a bunch of exploits that targeted Microsoft's products as well as some banks. And then a week later, Microsoft announced a few updates to those vulnerabilities, and there are a few theories as to what happened. Killian, you found this story. What are your opinions on how this all unfolded?
It seems, you know, we'll go back to the James Bond spy novel theme here a little bit. As part of that, kind of the warning bells went off when some of the security researchers did some tests and found out that these, you know, at the time what they thought were 0 days were still unpatched. But it turns out there was a couple of interesting things going on along that time. Microsoft had missed or decided not to participate in their, you know, ritual of Patch Tuesday, so they skipped one, and that sent some waves through the community. But it turns out that in the process, or I think it was in March, they kind of very quietly released patches for all of these what were thought to be 0 days at the time, and it went unnoticed by a lot of folks, especially some of the security researchers who had done the tests. They didn't realize that these were addressed kind of very, very silently. So these vulnerabilities had been in the products for years, I think, and there was some speculation on how, or maybe to quote some of that old Nixon era stuff, who knew and when did he know it type of information. So how did Microsoft kind of find out about this? And there was some speculation that they may have potentially purchased the information from the shadow brokers before it went out, or somebody from one of the compromised organizations had kind of on the back channel shared the information, realizing that the breach was, or the disclosure was imminent. So it's a little bit of a kind of spy intrigue there with this.
I guess it's so murky to me that it's really hard to tell if Microsoft inadvertently patched the vulnerabilities, like through some sort of static analysis or because it was something else. And then Shadow Broker said, like, oh, well, they're going to be patched. Let's release them quick now, or you know, the other way that Microsoft paid for them. I think it's impossible to know. I'm much more interested in the, I guess, the less James Bond and more the my vision of Q working on internal IT security at James Bond headquarters, that, you know, that's probably actually like 99% of Q's time isn't working on cars that shoot flames. It's like trying to get the patches deployed properly to all the servers internally, because that's the real threat. And that's where my mind goes is, well, so there's a very recent patch to these. They aren't technically 0 days, but how many servers out there are still vulnerable? And the answer is probably still millions. And so this is still a threat. It's still something that needs to be dealt with. And I'm not quite sure still if Microsoft and everyone involved did things properly in terms of warning or setting the expectations of their customers, everyone in IT, properly.
Take it away for the tool. So
PowerShell Mafia is the account that this was released under on GitHub, and the tool is PowerSploit. And what I really wanted to highlight was out of this, what they referred to as their recon tool. And so what's interesting to me, you know, we started this off by saying like, oh, well, there's open source software, something to get involved with. This is a great example. And so it's a great example in a number of ways. So it's PowerShell, which is something all modern sysadmins need to know. So it's very practical in that respect. It's interesting in that, especially the recon aspects of this, if it wasn't included in something from the PowerShell Mafia in a tool called PowerSploit, would be fairly boring system utilities in terms of, you know, like, oh, you want to do reverse DNS lookups on your network. Oh, you want to do some just monitoring of your network and seeing what's happening. And just how powerful those are when used in the context of like, oh, well, like you break in, and then once you break in, you use this to find out what the next server is that you then try to exploit. Yeah, so PowerSploit, and we'll put the link in the show notes to the GitHub repository, and in particular, check out the recon toolset script. That's it.
Thanks to Mike Buckby, Killian Englert, Chris Kaiser, and all our listeners for joining us today. If you want to follow us on Twitter to find some of the stories we're discussing, you can find us at infosec_podcast. Thanks, and we'll meet up again next week. Bye.
Bye. Thanks, Cindy.